Welcome back, everybody, to the Reflex Blue Show. We are still in the Heinz Convention Center here in lovely Boston, and we were just talking to our guest, Stefan Sagmeister, here, that this might be the nicest room in all of the state of Massachusetts. It's got an occupancy level of 133 people, so there's plenty of space, and it's got enough coat racks here to hang up probably all 133 coats, and the gray is very soothing.
Yeah, it has a warm gray stripy carpet and a cold gray wall covering fabric. There's mahogany accents you established, no?
Yeah.
It's definitely ruining my spirit and crushing my soul.
I could see this coming up in one of your upcoming pieces. I could see you using this color palette to sell product or something.
Yeah, if it's if the idea is to market plastic vomit from around the world,
okay, there's a big market,
I think,
for that.
Then, we might have the correct color vocabulary.
As we mentioned, as an added bonus, if we don't move around every here and there, the lights just go off in 20 minutes on us. So then you don't have to worry about your spirit being crushed, because you'll be like...
Keeps this interview lively.
Yeah, it's fun. So, Stefan, we actually met, and I'm sure you meet a lot of people. We actually met backstage at the Memphis AIJ conference.
Another gorgeous environment.
Yeah.
Of which I actually did do a talk about very recently. The Cook Convention Center in Memphis, Tennessee, which was literally so unbelievably ugly that it took me a couple of years, but I ultimately did do a talk about it, and I think it might be the basis of a much larger exploration on this entire situation where the second and third generation after the Bauhaus misunderstood the already flawed strategies of the Bauhaus completely and developed this economic functionalism that resulted in monsters like the Cook Convention Center in Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay, I just remember the Wi-Fi was even worse than the center itself. There was no internet connection in there.
I think that comes, considering that their entire idea was this place has to work, and absolutely nothing worked in there. I'm not surprised that the Wi-Fi was among the many things, but you know, neither the wayfinding nor one of the main functionalities of a convention center. You would think that it would be the transformation of a casual visitor to a place into a repeat visitor. And once you've been to the Cook Convention Center, you definitely don't want to have anything to do with Memphis, Tennessee anymore for the rest of your life. So I think that the only remnant of Memphis culture, of that unbelievably rich history, was woven into the worn down wall-to-wall carpeting of the floor that had some vague musical notes and piano patterns somehow featured in there. No, it was a very, very, very sad place.
Now, you speak at a lot of things. So have you ever been to a convention center where it's actually nice and you're like, wow, this place is great?
Lots.
Who's got the best?
The week before I had spoken at a castle in Lisbon, the São Jorge Castle. And now, this is a military building from the medieval times, from the dark medieval times. But everything in it was considered. The way you went in, it had a symmetrical staircase that was beautifully designed. The cannons themselves, like the instruments that were made to shoot at their enemies, had beautiful patterns all around it. No, this is completely new. This thinking is 20th century thinking, that we don't give a shit about anything. Let's just build it as cheaply as possible and see what happens. Like this was not part of humanity until, I would say, the 1930s and 40s. And I hope that we're going to get rid of it very quickly again.
I know we have issues. I'm from Omaha, and I'm on the mm-hmm. Public Art Commission there, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so they always bring in, like, they rebuilt a new baseball stadium, and they built, like, a convention center. And And then they come to the public art commission. We ask, like, well, what kind of public art are you doing? None. We have $0 for it.
Yeah. And I think, the thinking right now is all wrong about that. Because I even think that the thinking that says, oh, let's build some piece of shit and then put 1% of art in front of the piece of shit is all wrong.
Right, but they don't even do that.
Well,
yeah.
That's what I mean. We're not even there. But the thing is, all of it is deeply, deeply, deeply inhuman. And I mean that from the very, very bottom of my belly is... I give you an example. I recently bought a hand axe from eBay. This is the oldest instrument that we had as humanity. We had it. We invented it even before we were properly called humans. It's like a million years old, and we used it all the way until about 40,000 years. It's all of them, the African ones, the European ones, the American ones, they all look very similar. They all look like a perfectly symmetrical teardrop. And all of them are perfectly symmetrical, even though from a functional point of view, there's no need for them to be symmetrical. You could skin that bison or that mammoth just as well with a non-symmetrical tool. They made it symmetrical because it was better looking. And
I never thought of that. That's interesting.
So this is what it means to be human, and this bullshit that you're thinking, oh, we are building some shit stadium by some shit architecture company because they are building it the cheapest, and we'll do the same with the airport, and we'll do the same with the highway overpass, is deeply inhuman thinking. It's not what we are about. It's bullshit. It's stupid, and the worst excesses of it, you already see that we are basically dynamiting them. You know, if you look at the public housings that went up in the 50s and 60s, and the same thing is gonna happen to these shit baseball stadiums and these shit airports. They are deeply inhuman. This is not what we want to be.
Do you think?
Clearly, you can tell I'm passionate about it.
No, that's great, and but do you think? I mean, where's the hope? Like, is there one group of people, a certain country that's doing it right that we can follow? Like,
I think that you see it even in this country. If you look at a development like the High Line in New York, this is a deeply functional building, came out of functionalism, meaning a train track built for goods to be carried, was staying empty for 30, 40 years, rediscovered by two activists, and they made a big brahu about, and ultimately Diller and Scofidio were commissioned to renovate this High Line. Diller and Scofidio being the same architecture firm who also did the ICA in Boston right here, which I visited yesterday, and which is a beautiful, wonderful piece of architecture and museum. The High Line is an unbelievably functioning building, and functioning from many points of view. People love it, dearly love it, are protective of it, donate money to it. It has, when the weather is good, tens of thousands of people enjoying it every day. It's almost a victim of its own success. Sometimes it gets too crowded because people love it too much. It's probably the most influential building that went up in Manhattan, maybe after World War II. I happen to run on it every morning. Basically, every other day you see a group of guys and women in black standing around in non-jogging clothes, so you know it's some sort of foreign architecture group studying it and checking it out. I already saw a couple of buildings that were clearly inspired by it 2 weeks ago in Louisville, Kentucky, where they transformed a old railway bridge over the river into a bike and walking path, also quite nicely done, not quite as nicely as the High Line, but also very well done. And most surprisingly, there was an art, it's now the High Line is open maybe 4 to 5 years, and there was an article recently in the New York Times that showed that since the opening of the High Line, not a single piece of crime had been reported on the High Line, even though millions of people were on there. So not a handbag stolen.
Yeah, I remember going to an AIG leadership retreat in Pittsburgh, and they had a guy speak there, and he was building a a place to teach the kids who, you know, they would be on the street, like how to be chefs and stuff. And they're in a rough area, but he goes, there was no issues because the community embraced it and they loved it.
These things are doable. So I think Highland will be one example, but there is many, many around. I mean, as far as conference centers or talking centers is concerned, I think by and large, Europe is doing a much better job than this country, also as far as airports is concerned. You know, these buildings, just like they used to be in the United States, if you look at a transportation building from the 19th century, look at Grand Central in New York. This is a grand building. There are countries that let's build something proper. Yes, it has 10 times the ceiling height that's necessary. Yes, it will cost more than 1 times the ceiling heights, but we'll do this because we can, and this is part of our pride. And airports like this are still built. The Munich airport is wonderful. It's brand new. It's 2 years old. The Zurich airport is excellent. You land there. It's a joy to be there. They are calm. They are, I mean, I wouldn't quite say serene, but they're nice places to land. And meaning if you've been around in airports in this country, I mean, almost without exception, they're awful. I mean, there are bubbles of discontent. It's very difficult to stay in a good mood while visiting one. I mean, there's numerous reasons for that. It's not just the buildings, but ultimately, I think if you live in a place, if you live in a city right now, anywhere in the world, which most of us do.
Yeah.
More of us live in cities than not. And so everything that surrounds us in a city, everything will be designed. Everything, including the microphone, the table the microphone stands on,
the carpet. This gorgeous room. This gorgeous room that is.
The center, the street, the neighborhood, the city. Everything, including every tree in it, has been considered and designed. And as we see, if you look at the difference between, I don't know, let's say Paris and Canberra, this can be done very well, and this can be done very badly. And this influence is the same exact influence than, let's say, if you're a indigenous person, nature would have on you. Because if you're an indigenous person, everything that surrounds you would be natural, with a couple of exceptions of the stuff that you designed yourself, like your spear and maybe whatever clothing you might have on.
Sure.
So clearly, those surroundings influence our lives. And we have a choice. We can do this. This can be done by people with talent, or this can be done by idiots. Now, of course, clearly, this room has been designed by an idiot. I mean, there is no doubt about it. It's, you know, this is likely probably the center at one time was maybe designed by somebody proper. But when it came down to design this room, it was somebody deep, deep in the trenches in that architecture office. I mean, you just look at the details, you know, all these outlets. Look, I mean, how this is not even straight. This has all been done without love and care in an extremely sloppy, I don't give a shit kind of manner. And I think that if we continue to design the world that surrounds us in a non-loving, sloppy, we don't care, it's a shit job, I don't give a shit kind of manner, well, we'll get this room.
All right. And hopefully the lights will go on us soon. But
exactly.
All right. We'll be right back. All right, Stefan, while we have you here too, I need to ask you, what is your talk at Howe about? Like, what are you're actually brought in here to speak? Is the main talk to talk about how great this carpet is, or?
I'm actually talking here about happiness, as you can clearly feel by my sunny disposition. I'm talking about things that would work within for me as a designer, and things that don't work for me as a designer.
Well, what makes you happy then?
There's two answers. There's answers of stuff that makes me happy as a designer, and there is stuff that makes me happy as a person. And I'd say, specifically as a designer, would be the ability to think without any deadlines, so that I can go after a thought without anything looming yet, and it's specifically when I'm in a different city.
Okay.
And specifically when I really sit down and do it and don't procrastinate and make coffee or go to the loo or do something else instead, I would say when something works out, so I think in the talk I call this when something comes back well from the printer, but ultimately it's a sense of accomplishment of if a thing just worked out and there is an end point to it and you have some sort of thing in your hand that you think, oh wow, this last 6 years that I put into this thing really ultimately was worthwhile. Which is why I still, that's also probably has something to do with my age, but I still can get a bigger kick out of having designed a book really, really carefully than I would have from having designed a part of a microsite, where our, you know, influence might be much more difficult to gouge and where it's more difficult to see that sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, and I always find it's fun too, because you, with like anything that's online and stuff, the potential of more people seeing it is there, but not having it in your hands, you do miss out on that. And I do mostly websites, but even like getting a stationary setback, you're like, oh, that job's done. Where the website launches and then next week it's not there. You kind of forget it's there.
But it was very surprising. And I definitely don't want to go down some nostalgia route here. I was surprised, though, that at OFF, you know, which is it's a very young conference in Barcelona.
Okay.
There were many, many people in their beginning 20s coming up to me asking how they can get a job in print. And it was just like, really? This is what you want to do? But I think at the extreme center of this is the sense of accomplishment. Is that it's very difficult. Like, you know, these are mostly people who would work for a large newspaper online or, you know, who work on giant sites. It's very difficult to gauge what influence you really had and what meaning your work has. Because I think that all jobs that we do have good points and bad points. Even the most meaningful things, like we can work on the most fantastic NGO that I deeply believe in, there still will be a point where it's difficult. But I think at those points where it becomes difficult, it's wonderful to know that you feel that the stuff that you do has meaning. And ultimately, I think that the best description that I saw of what that means, that a job would have meaning, comes from a guy called Alan de Botton. And he basically says, we find a job meaningful if it either delights or helps somebody else. And I checked all of the work that we had done, and that turned out to be totally true, meaning that a thing that we've done 18 years ago, if I feel it delighted somebody, or if it helped somebody, or in the few cases maybe did both, I'm still glad I did that. And if it did neither, I don't care about it at all. Yeah, I think ultimately, if I can be involved in a job that does one or the other, and of course, in many cases, the way we do it can do one or the other. You know, we can do, I don't know, this room that we are in, to come back to my little subject of the day, this room that we are in could be delightful.
Yeah, it's got like high ceilings. It's got large doors.
There is absolute potential. The room that we're in could be a delightful room. And that would also mean that the person who designed it could think of that room as a meaningful job that they did. Now I can guarantee you that the person who designed this room does not think of this as a meaningful job. Maybe the whole center, maybe the person who did the whole thing because they have much more ownership.
Right.
But the person who actually who worked on this one, my very informed guess would be that they saw this as some also thing that they needed to do. It was, you know, the 8th tier conference room, and they did it fast and quickly, and they didn't really give much of a shit about it. But it could be delightful, and it possibly could be helpful. Now, of course, in some ways, it probably is helpful, because if it rains, it would secure that we don't get wet, possibly.
There's two floors above it. If this room leaks, we're in a lot of trouble. That's the least of the problems.
Well, not all the airports that I've been through lately were able to function on such a basic level. If you landed at LaGuardia anytime in the last couple of years when it rained, you see gigantic buckets on wheels standing around that they wheel out every time it rains, and then they have big sort of like plastic hanging things on hooks with hoses attached to them with a yellow sauce rinsed down from the styrofoam ceiling. It's a thing to be seen. I mean, it's considering that you've just landed in what often claims to be, you know, the capital of the world, and their answer to rain is buckets on wheels to...
And the airport is like literally the first impression people get of your city.
Oh, yes, the first impression. Yeah. No, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. It's all brought to you by the power of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Yeah, the same guys who did the bridge closing to settle some... political fights.
Oh, yes, yes. That's been entertaining in the news. Yeah, so. Well, Stefan, we thank you very much for your time. It's great to have you on. And
It was a pleasure.
All right, and your website, is it Sagmeister.com or is it now
Sagmeister? It is Sagmeister.
SagmeisterWalsh.com. SagmeisterWalsh.com.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Beery is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.